Now, back to Good Morning New Hampshire with Peter St. James and Pat Kelly on 107.7 The Pulse.
Okay, Tokyo, South America.
Was 85?
Ooh.
I have the 45.
Do you really?
But there's nothing printed on the label. They shipped them out so quickly. There's no writing, no label, no title, no nothing. You have to put it on the turntable to find out what the song is.
Wow.
So you'd think that that was an anomaly worth thousands of dollars so I could retire. Such is not the case. 9:33 is the time. It is our pleasure to welcome in Andrew, just call me Andy Valinsky, the executive counselor for District 2. I can't believe you've been in for like 3 years, and this is the first time we've had you on the air.
Yeah, my bad. I apologize.
That's all right. We'll make you pay for it. Don't worry.
Fair enough.
Seriously, Andrew, it's great to have you on. As your in your capacity as executive counselor, and also candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. Let's shift to council first before we get to the other. A lot of people still don't understand what the executive council is, and when we say, "Well, we need to save money, get rid of the council," because I think they don't understand what it is.
Yeah, no, don't get rid of the council. there are others that should go first. So look. Think of the council as New Hampshire's board of directors. There are five of us. We each represent about a fifth of the state, about 275,000 people. Our job really revolves around the three C's: contracts, confirmations, and commuting. So ordinarily, every state contract over $10,000 has to be approved by a majority of the councilors. And you can't buy light bulbs for a state for less than $10,000. So that gives us a broad range of influence to make sure things are done on the up and up and to make things transparent. So that's first responsibility. Confirmations, the governor nominates people for all the state commissions and boards. The governor nominates the department heads and all the judges. But none of them take office unless the majority of the council approve. And for the most part, maybe 90 or 95% of those nominees are approved. They're appropriate. But, you know, more than occasionally, the governor's put through a clunker who wasn't qualified for the position, and the majority of the council turned them down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second C. The last C is commuting. The council starts the process for the revising of our 10-year transportation plan every other year. And this past cycle, I happen to have chaired that process. So we hold public hearings around the state. I think last cycle we held 22 hearings in each of the council districts. And then we put together the first draft of the plan. It goes from us to the governor, from the governor to the legislature, and that's how you do transportation planning in New Hampshire. Mm. So in a nutshell, that's what the council does. I've been on the council. This is my second term, so I'm about halfway through the second term. We have a very collegial body, even though we have very distinct differences in our political outlook and our policy focus. We must get 100 contracts for review every other week. We get them on a Friday afternoon, and we vote on them the following Wednesday. As I said, there have been some clunker nominations. The governor nominated someone who wasn't qualified to be Environmental Services Commissioner. And after my questioning of that person, he was withdrawn, and we got Bob Scott, who's the current commissioner, and he's great, understands what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bit of a tiff over the governor's nomination of Gordon McDonald.
Wait a minute. A bit of a tiff? That's how you categorize it? It was big. You were getting hammered on that one.
I got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Gordon McDonald, who's our current attorney general, is a lawyer that I've known, but he's never been a judge. So putting him as the top judge in our entire judicial system didn't make sense to me. He's never completed a jury trial. I've probably done 100 jury trials, so I know what's involved. He doesn't. And Gordon has a 30-year documented history of antagonism towards reproductive rights. And I, for one, don't believe we should remake society from the bench. And so three of us opposed Gordon, and he was not confirmed. And here's the thing that's unusual. That was last July, mid-July. The governors refused to nominate a new justice. So for all of this time, we've operated with only four seats filled. And if the governor's reelected, he'll put up Gordon McDonald again and try again to undermine reproductive rights. So that's what we do as counselors.
Does it bother you when that whole thing came down, you were accused of just politically grandstanding? Because if I remember correctly, some legal organizations spoke highly of Attorney General McDonald and thought he would be impeccable, good qualifications, blah, blah, blah. And when you when it came down 3-2, you were the one that was accused of doing it for political expediency. Did that bother you?
Look, I can't allow it to bother me. My view of this job and governor, if I'm lucky enough to win that, is that I should go where the facts direct me and where my values direct me and be open and transparent about that, but never to cave to pressure. There was an organized effort to support Gordon McDonald. You've mentioned how some of it worked out. I had lots of friends in that organized effort. I've been a lawyer in New Hampshire for almost 40 years. I knew a lot of those people, and I listened. I mean, access is not a problem, but at the end of the day, a judge without experience shouldn't lead our court system. Now, if Gordon had been put up for trial judge, where most appellate judges start out, that would have been another thing. I voted for McDonald as attorney general. He's not a bad lawyer, but he has no experience as a judge. And quite frankly, as chief of staff for Senator Gordon Humphrey, Gordon McDonald and Gordon Humphrey tried to pass a constitutional amendment to reverse Roe versus Wade. And when I asked him at his confirmation hearing, have you ever expressed a more moderate view than that extreme position? He looked at me and said, of course not. And that's not who we want for our justices. We want people there who don't have an agenda, who don't have an axe to grind. And I'm sorry people disagreed with me. But I'll tell you one thing. Sununu knew before the vote that he was going to lose. And my colleague, Deborah Pignatelli, approached him and said, let's not embarrass the attorney general. Let's do this quietly. And Sununu insisted on a public vote. We were in Littleton on the road for our meeting. That was all grandstanding. That was all politics. Didn't have to happen that way. Poor Gordon didn't have to sit in the front row and listen to us vote against him.
So is that why we haven't had a subsequent nomination? That he's afraid that whoever he picks is going to be shot down?
Respectfully, that's his BS position. He's keeping the position open so that if he wins re-election,
okay, and
I'll be gone, he'll bring up Gordon again.
So why are you going to be gone? You sound like you enjoy what you're doing. You're making a difference. You've got convictions. God bless you. You have principles, unlike many people I know. So why do you want to leave that and roll the dice?
I've learned in the 3 years that I've been on the council that there's a lot you can do as a counselor, but it's always responsive. It is the governor who sets the agenda, not the council.
Right.
And if you want to make progress on things that I care about, like quality of our schools, bringing down property taxes, taking aggressive action on the climate, you have to control the governor's position, have the bully pulpit, and really encourage the state to move forward. Look, property taxes have gone up every year since Chris Sununu's been on the executive council and as governor. He doesn't have that on his radar. As a matter of fact, he's made it worse by downshifting state responsibilities to local communities. And I want to stop the downshift. I can't do that as counselor. I have a chance of doing that as a leader in the state as governor.
Mm-hmm. How's it going?
You know, this isn't the campaign I signed up for.
Yeah, I know. It's extremely difficult in this, you know, we can't get more than 10 people together thing.
Yeah, we stopped. We were the first campaign that stopped in-person events because I didn't think it was ethical to put people at risk. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of time on the phone, calling people broadly around the state,
sure, checking
in, see how they're doing. And then we're using Zoom really well. So we've had Zoom meetings for my campaign with 50 to 85 generally.
Oh, great.
Okay. People joining us. We do two a week like that, and then we get invited to town committee Zooms.
Mm-hmm.
And those are smaller. They're organized by the towns, maybe 15 or 20. The silver lining is that I couldn't ordinarily in a campaign go to those small meetings.
Right.
Because you'd have to drive an hour or two to get there.
Absolutely.
Meet 15 people and leave. But now I can go to my home office where I'm standing right now, flip open the computer, do a 45-minute or an hour meeting, do two of them back-to-back, and, you know, meet 15 activists. So we've done that with town committees, we've done that with labor organizations, activist organizations. That part's very productive.
Right, because their FaceTime with you is a good thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to not being able to make it to those smaller meetings.
Well, and depending how the pandemic plays out, and according to Dr. Fauci, how the pandemic plays out, with the advent of the regular flu season coming in just about the same time in the fall, turnout, you know, may be good, it may be eh. So the more committed people you get, those are the ones that show up to vote.
Right.
You're absolutely right. And so that's productive. But I got to say, I like interacting with people.
I know.
And I really do miss that. Maybe it's part of being a trial lawyer. You know, I've always spent my days in courthouses around the country, sometimes interacting with groups of 12, and I really do miss that, I got to say.
I know.
But, you know, we can do things like radio more frequently, and I enjoy this as well. So it's not a complete substitute, but, you know, thank you for doing this with me.
Oh, no, happy to do it.
No, yeah, this is what we do.
Hey, look, you're getting some quality time with Scooter, okay? It's all good. Scooter is his goat.
So you know about my goat?
Yeah, I know about your goat. And actually, you and I share something. You and I both had the, at least from my standpoint, I will not speak for you, I will let you do it. I had the privilege of attending the Commandant's National Security Program at the U.S. Army War College, and I know you did as well. And to me, that was some of the best time I ever spent.
I am so glad you brought that up. I went last summer. For those who don't know, it's a week-long program for civilians to join colonels and lieutenant colonels, essentially finishing their master's degrees at the Army War College. The group I was in with had regular and reserve Army, Marine, Navy, and Air Force, so it was a mix. And they were such thoughtful people. I really enjoyed the classes. I enjoyed the informal interaction. And, you know, you and I are invited to those kinds of things so that these people who will be senior officers soon know how to interact with the media on your part and senior elected officials on my part. But I was like a kid in a candy store. It was just a great treat me to be there.
You know, and then you're right. Hearing from the ambassadors, hearing from RAND Corporation people, the briefings were awesome. And looking at the next generation of military leadership, boy, I'll tell you, if you didn't feel good about our military, you did when you left.
Yeah, I did going in, but they were an impressive, very thoughtful group. The attention to developing leaders and leadership skills, it's often missed in civil society.
Oh, yeah.
And to watch these folks focus on it, you know, I've done things like Outward Bound and Leadership New Hampshire, and so I have a little bit of that. But these folks are thinking about it. It's very intentional. And then, I'm sure you did this, Peter, we got the guided Army historian tour of Gettysburg.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes, and I had been to Gettysburg twice before that. Nothing like this. It was phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. My former work colleague and good friend, Senator Angus King, does a lecture about Joshua Chamberlain.
Oh, sure.
At Gettysburg. And I've been to that lecture, and then to go walk and look at where everyone was, and to think of the Southern Confederate soldiers running uphill into this well-protected position and Pickett's charge, all of it was
And being a born and raised Maine boy, I mean, Chamberlain was, you know, part of my lineage, and to stand on Little Round Top, and when I was there a few years ago, that they had started cutting the trees to make the area look like it did in 1863. And to see that the 20th Maine was over here stopping the, and I don't remember whether it was Arkansas or Texas, them from flanking. Had they flanked, got around the 20th Maine, they could have taken Little Round Top. The battle would have changed dramatically. But seeing where Chamberlain was, it's like, oh, my God. And to stand there on Cemetery Ridge going, wait a minute, or at the Peach Orchard, seriously, you guys walked across this field into those cannons behind the stone wall? Oh, you do not have a perception of the Civil War until you've stood where they stood and you went, oh, my God. It's very moving.
And for me, there were some real stories about the arrogance of leadership. General Lee's order to Pickett. To make the charge, because he so badly underestimated the Northern troops and their cannons. Just, you know, I've not been in the military, but it just underscored for me how we need to think and rethink and be sure of our facts, and rely on data as we're making leadership decisions. And that's been my mantra. It's become more pressing in these COVID-19 times. For too long, we've been reliant on insufficient testing to try and make plans to deal with the virus or come out of the lockdowns. And often the apparently good test results are really a failure of testing rather than real data. Sure. And I think of Lee's orders when I'm trying to analyze those things. What information do I have? What do I think I have? How reliable is it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how we should lead and how we should govern.
We're going to have to take a break. Let me paraphrase Abraham Lincoln when he met Harriet Beecher Stowe. He said, "Oh, you're the little woman that gave me this big war. You're the man who gave us Claremont School funding. You're the guy." Well, I'm trying to do a Civil War analogy, Andy. Come on.
Here you are waxing eloquent, and I'm thinking, where's he going with this?
Yeah, I know. I brought it back to Claremont. Come on. Because that's why you're running for governor, right? More than anything else.
If Claremont had been resolved, if we had improved the quality of our schools broadly, if we had adopted fair ways to pay for it, if everyone was paying their fair share, I would never have run for office.
Right. You wouldn't have to because you would have done your work. Right.
I worked mightily and could not get it done. And so this is a different approach. Being a politician was not my first choice for a career goal. I admit that I'm rather reluctant at it. But the issues are too important. And we have now a state that's gotten a lot worse since my Claremont days. We are now three-quarters reliant on the local property tax for paying for our schools, which works just fine if you live on a lake or you have a ski hill. But in the vast majority of our communities, you struggle and you struggle and you struggle and you still don't get it done.
Yep.
You know, Manchester is a good example. Manchester should have the strongest school system in the state. Instead, it spends less per pupil than any other community in New Hampshire by thousands.
Wow. Andrew, hang on a second. Sorry, okay. We're going to back up to the wall. We have to take a quick break. Have your coffee, water, what?
We're going to hardly have any time on the backside.
We're not?
No.
So what?
So I
go
let's
two?
Keep the, let's keep talking for another minute and a half.
Okay, there you go. Sorry. All right.
Sorry.
I didn't want to cut you off in mid statement. Well, right. We've got a hard break we have to pay attention to. So.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, I didn't mean to distract you. You were on a roll. You were sounding very, very political.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to sound informational. So for the last 2 years, my friends from the Claremont days, John Tobin, Doug Hall, and I, have conducted about 70 forums around the state explaining how school funding works. And, you know, people leave the Q&A session after the forum wanting to march on Concord because the system is really, really unfair.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts communities, more and more communities. So we used to think it hurt Claremont and Pittsfield and Berlin. But Manchester is suffering, Rochester is suffering, Nashua is struggling. It's hard to pay for our schools, and those who seem to pay the most get the least. So the tax rate in Claremont is $25 per thousand for its schools, and it raises about $15,000 per kid. The tax rate in Moultonboro is $4.
Right.
And they raise $25,000 per kid.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got about 30 seconds. Let me ask you, I'm not asking you if this is where you want to go, but given the fact that tourism, COVID has nailed us, rooms and meals tax, business, do we still stay as a property tax-based state, or is it time to look at alternate?
I think it's long past time. COVID makes it real. But we should have had this discussion 15 years ago.
All right. Look, Andy, it's been a blast. Would you come back?
It would be my honor to do that. Let's figure out how to do that.
This is pretty much all we do. I mean, it's just a normal conversation. We're not looking for gotchas. We're looking for imparting information because we think our listeners, if you put the information out, they will think about it and they will make the right decision. Right. All we're trying to do is put it out there. So we will extend an invitation. We will get you back and we'll continue the chat.
Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
You stay safe and healthy, and we'll talk again soon.
You got it. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Okay.
Andrew Valinsky, Executive Counsel, District 2, and Democratic gubernatorial candidate. We're taking a break.